This is Bob Lang with the Oral History Project at the University of Wisconsin at Madison. Today is March 14th, 2006. The interview today is with Emeritus Professor of Physics, Maurice Barney Webb. And before we do anything else, I have to ask you where the nickname of Barney came from. It seems a long way from Maurice.
Yes, I had an uncle, Morris Barnett, who happened to be killed in World War I, and his name was Morris Barnett with a nickname Barney, and I was named after him with his name.
I see, okay. To begin the interview, if you would tell us when you were born and where, and a little bit about your parents and your early growing up years.
I was born in May 1926, and my parents were, I was born in Neenah, Wisconsin.
Oh.
And my parents, my father ran a family hardware store, which is still there and run by the family, and now I think 155 years old.
In Neenah.
In Neenah. What was the next?
And a little bit about your mother.
She grew up in Neenah. She went to Lawrence College for a few years. Married my father just before World War I.
Yes, yeah. Tell me a little bit about your father.
Grew up in Thornton, Illinois. Went a few semesters to the University of Chicago, and dropping out alternately to work. Went off to World War I, came back and became an actuary, and then finally came back to Neenah to join this family business to my mother's side.
I see. And where had he and your mother met?
In Neenah, when he came there for a short while as an actuary with an insurance company.
Interesting. And then you were born in 1926. And,
yes.
And did you grow up in Neenah then?
Yes, I grew up in Neenah.
And you went to the public schools there?
I probably led a somewhat sheltered childhood because my older sister had been kidnapped. And
how terrible.
Yes, she survived this. She had been kidnapped. And after that happens, I think it's usual that the family gets prank extortion letters and things like that. And so I think my parents were probably pretty careful of us kids.
Yes. Was it just the two of you, you and your sister?
No, I have a, between us, I have a brother who was running this hardware store still.
Interesting. So as you think back on your education and your subsequent career as one of the country's leading physicists, what were there some early intellectual influences, some teachers that stand out in your memory?
Oh, there are ones that I remember. Vida Smith was a high school mathematics teacher, and she was very good. There was a really fine biology teacher. There was a very nice but not particularly good physics teacher.
Did you know early on, or at least in high school, that you were inclined toward math and science, that that's what interested you the most?
Not particularly. In fact, I remember in civics class you had to write some essay about what you thought you might want to do, and at that time I, for some reason, thought I might be a lawyer. Back when I started college, I was a pre-med for the first semester.
Interesting. Well, lots of us don't know.
I changed majors, I think, three times as a undergraduate.
Interesting. Is it safe to assume that your family placed a high premium on education?
Yes. I don't know that how much of a point of discussion and so forth. It was just always assumed that Chicago and so forth.
So you probably would have graduated from high school in the early 1940s, or mid-1940s.
I graduated in 1944.
Okay.
And I went to the Navy for a couple of years.
Right out of high school?
Right.
Were you drafted?
No. I enlisted in Navy program for electronic technicians and so on.
And how did you choose that?
I was at first I thought to enlist in the Naval Air Corps. But I was too short.
Oh.
I couldn't get it.
So this was a way to get into the Navy.
And stay out of the Army.
And where did you spend those next 2 years?
Well, there was something like maybe 9 months of various schools. And then I spent about a year on Maui, Hawaii, maintaining and installing and calibrating radar and communications and navigation gear on carrier-based aircraft.
I see. So you would have been in Hawaii while the war was still going on, before it had ended?
Just a little bit.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So you certainly, you remember the dropping of the atomic bomb?
I wasn't there.
No, but...
But, yeah, I remember the news.
Yeah. And, but you had enlisted for 2 years in the Navy, so you had to stay till 46?
Well, at that time, you enlisted he would miss it for, not for a period, but for the duration. And then there was a point system to determine the sequence of discharges.
Mm-hmm.
And because I had only been there for, since summer 44, I was a little later getting out than if I had been in for a longer period.
Did you know that when you came out you would go to college? Was that your plan?
It was always, there just wasn't any question if you were going to go to college.
And so you were discharged finally in 1946?
I think in probably June of 1946.
And then you came home and entered the university?
Well, I entered the university in September.
Uh-huh. Did you consider going anyplace other than the UW?
Not that I remember. It just would assume that that's where you were going to go to college.
So you started here in the fall of 46 and then graduated in 1950, I assume.
Right.
What was, you've alluded to your major, what was your undergraduate curriculum like? What courses did you take? What professors do you remember?
Oh, well, I started out as the first semester as a pre-med. At that time, you started mathematics with analytic geometry and advanced algebra and so forth, and you started, as usual, that you started calculus in the beginning of your sophomore.
Mm-hmm.
So, in my freshman year, I took a marvelous course in expository composition in a temporary Quonset hut on Brooks Library Mall.
Huh.
With PA, who was a somewhat older woman, during class we read essays, and we dissected essays in an elderly habit. And I asked her one day, why do we spend so much more time on each word than the author ever did? And she said, well, that's because he had done it before. Well, she was marvelous. We wrote one paper for the whole semester, but we handed it in probably six times, and it came back more red than not. We met her in her office and talked about this. We spent the whole semester doing one paper. That was a wonderful course.
So that's where you really learned how to write.
Well, to any extent that I might have learned, that's where that would have been the choice. I had, can't remember his name, a very fine chemistry lecturer in my freshman year. He was very good, but obviously not been a researcher because he wasn't retain.
But he was very teacher. He was a good math teacher.
So I started as a pre-med, and I enjoyed chemistry so much that I think it was in the beginning of my second semester I switched majors to chemistry. And then I took my sophomore year in beginning physics. I had Rollison for my teacher. And I got so interested in physics that then I, after that year, I changed majors to physics.
And Barney, what was it that so interested you about physics?
Oh, I don't know how to say. It was just fun and very interesting, and it was I guess that straightforward.
So you knew that it was sufficiently interesting that you could pursue it as your career?
I think so. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Who were some of the key professors of physics then?
At that time?
Yes.
I think Ingersoll had been the chairman when I started, the freshman or sophomore, but he died, and Raleigh became chairman, Rollison became chairman. I had a fellow named Joe Dillinger for a couple of classes. I had a class from Heinz Barshaw, and he was very helpful and friendly. I had a class from Ray Herb, who was a very prominent physicist, essentially invented or reinvented the made practical Van de Graaff generators, which made the University of Wisconsin a leading physics department in nuclear physics. So I had him for a class. That was funny. He would copy from the textbook into the notebook, and then he'd come to class with the notebook, and he would copy his notebook on the blackboard. And it would be essentially word for word what was in the textbook. Of course, he edited it, so we had important things. But as soon as you stopped in with a question, then he was magnificent. Explained. Mm-hmm. Who else? Well, There were several, but those are the ones that come to mind.
Were you doing any research in physics as an undergraduate, or were you just taking the courses?
I was mainly taking the courses. I did a few things. In some summers, I as an undergraduate, I went up and worked at the Institute of Paper Chemistry in Appleton.
Oh. And what did you do there?
I worked in the lab doing various projects for the guys I was working for, which were development of paper coatings in one case and optical properties in another summer and so forth.
Mm-hmm. You're coming back to the university and you graduate in the spring of 1950.
Correct.
And what did you do from at that point? Did you go on to graduate school or did you go to work?
No, I that summer I worked again in Appleton, but then I started graduate school here.
Oh, you went to graduate school here at Wisconsin?
Yes.
Working directly for a PhD, or did you go for a master's first?
I don't think there was any real distinction. A master's in physics wasn't a degree that you set out to do in some sense. The master's was a consolation prize, not making up to PhD. A master's was kind of automatic as you went through the system, but it wasn't a goal.
Uh-huh. And what was your goal? I mean, I know you were going to get a PhD, but had you settled on an area of physics that you wanted to work in?
I don't know why, but at the time, the department was a very prominent department in nuclear physics experiment. Mm-hmm. With Rayhard and Hans Barshall, Simpson, and reasons that I don't particularly remember, I was never particularly interested in doing nuclear physics. There was also, there had just started a group in low temperature physics, and Wisconsin had one of the first helium liquefiers.
Oh.
And they hired a group of three people to start this low temperature physics. And one of them was a guy named Frank Rogers. In my first year, I started working with him. Time when the U.S. was worried about Russian bombers, particularly Russian bombers attacking over the North Pole. And there was a big project at Lincoln Lab at MIT, which was worrying about continental air defense. Building what was called the Dew Line. And Rollison took lead from here and was a pretty high level administrator at Project Lincoln. And he asked my then major professor Frank Rogers to come for a time to Project Lincoln, and he also invited his three graduate students. So,
oh.
I reckon spent a year working there. I was the only one to come back.
To Wisconsin?
To Wisconsin. I'm glad you stayed with that group, and so did Dick Dexter. He was a graduate student. He finished his degree there. A very famous experiment. And then he came back here on the faculty. And the other one, of the students, Jim Meyer, stayed there permanently. So when I came back, I didn't have my same major professor. And I started to work with Bill Demon in X-ray, small angle X-ray scattering. And I finished in that. That was my thesis.
And how did you pick him?
Well, again, I don't remember that particularly. I guess the best I can say is I'm very happy that I did. I must have known him and some of the students that worked for him. He was a very, very fine physicist, Mr. Graham Fellows.
And so when did you finally get your PhD degree?
In 1956. They were short of faculty and staff. So when I was getting close to finishing, they asked me to teach a course by myself. So I taught heat and thermodynamics while I was still a graduate student. Then I got married, and my wife was finishing her PhD with John Ferry in the chemistry department. And Bill Demon, who was a great friend, but he delayed my degree for a month until after my wife had her degree, so that he could introduce us as Dr. and Mr. Rex.
That is a wonderful story. And what was your PhD thesis?
I did a thesis on the small angle scattering from cold work metals. There had been a small angle scattering is a process which you can learn about the size of objects that are size of macromolecules or things like that. And it had been observed first by a Frenchman, Guignan, that when you had a metal which had been deformed, it gave small angle scattering, and it was thought to have been due to the scattering from bubbles in the metal. And at this time, solid-state physics had a lot to do with dislocations and deformations and so forth. And Phil even had an earlier student who had done various annealing experiments that could not be understood by that simple picture. And so I don't know quite how it happened, but I thought that it might have been an entirely different scattering mechanism. So I did an experiment measuring the polarization of the scattered X-rays, which showed that it was not scattering in density fluctuations, but in fact was doubled scattering, first from one little grain of metal, then subsequently. So that was a fun experiment, but now I continue to do so.
This is side two, tape one, Emeritus Professor of Physics, Maurice Barney Webb, March 14th, 2006. I was asking you about your dissertation committee.
I don't remember completely. I remember the prelim committee much better. At that time, maybe I shouldn't talk about that, but it's kind of interesting.
Oh, no, you should talk about it.
At that time, physics prelim was a day-long written exam. At the end of that day, they give you a topic from the literature that you were supposed to prepare the first 20 to 30 minutes of your oral, which would be in the following week. And I was assigned cyclotron resonance, which had in solids, which had just been discovered perhaps a month or two earlier. And it was an experiment in which you measured what's called the effective mass of the electrons in silicon. And I had never even heard of an effective mass, and I certainly didn't know anything about this, and there was only a short paragraph almost in the literature and the letters in the Physical Review. So I was panicked. My exam was on, oral was on that next Friday morning. It just so happened that on the day before, on Thursday, named Volker Heinen, who became a very important theoretical physicist at Cambridge, England, came through to visit on his way from California, where he had been with the people who had done this discovery of cyclotron resonance in silicon.
Oh my.
And he, on that Thursday afternoon, gave what we call a recent paper seminar talk. And I sat in the back and I took notes. And the next morning in my oral, I repeated his talk. And that went all right. Until Julian Mack, who was a marvelous professor here, started with a question to him, and his first question was that whenever he heard about the dynamics of an electron, it always depended on the ratio of the charge to the mass. Why did we talk about an effective mass rather than an effective charge? I have no idea, but Bob Sachs, who was on the committee, Bob wanted you to know that he knew essentially everything. And so, rather than letting me answer, he started to answer. And he and Julian then started arguing back and forth, and I just nodded from one to the other. So that was my freedom for it.
So they finally let you go and said that you had passed.
Yeah, well, the way the exam was given, that the first hour was your little toddling questions about it, and the second hour were questions in general about anything in physics. So after that, they let me go.
And so then you proceeded to work on your dissertation itself and presented that maybe a year later?
I don't remember. Maybe 2 years later, which would have been pretty normal. And you usually have started your research before your prelims.
Mm-hmm.
I started with the Wharf Fellowship, so I didn't PA in the beginning. Then I went to MIT. Then I came back, and it must have been that year, at the end of that year, so I had probably been working on four buildings for a year by the time I got
there. I see. Now, while you were working on your degree, you were also teaching as a TA?
Maybe for one semester.
Uh-huh.
First I was on a Wharf Fellowship, and when I came back, I think I taught for a semester, and after that, I must have been supported by Bill Beeman's research grants until I got a Kodak Fellowship some kind. And then that last year or semester, I taught that course.
Did you find those couple TAing episodes that you had, did you find that you liked teaching and that you thought you might be a professor someday?
Yes. I don't remember when I finished or when I was as I was finishing, I interviewed both at universities, and I have a couple of postdoc offers from other universities, and I interviewed at two or three industrial laboratories, and I finally decided we went to Schenectady and worked in the GE Research Laboratory.
Oh, you did?
Yes. And I was there about 5 years.
And that was a very conscious decision. You chose to do that rather than take a postdoc or a teaching job?
Oh yeah, at that time, the GE Research Lab was a fantastically good laboratory. At that time, as good as battle axe.
Really?
Yeah. It was a superb leather cutting. And I remember the conversation. There was a guy named Milan Fisker who had, many years before, been a graduate student from Wisconsin.
Oh.
And he kept calling me after they had made me an offer, and I was considering another offer. He kept calling me, and I remember one conversation where he said, you know, coming here can be the equivalent of a superb postdoc. And with that, it was just that there was so much going on there, and so many good people there. Mm-hmm. That's probably why I've been very clear in my mind how the decision was made. That was probably the reason for the choice.
And what were you? What did GE hire you to work on?
Well, they didn't really. I left and I joined a group that was headed by a fellow named Dave Turnbull, who subsequently went to Harvard and became an exceedingly prominent scientist. Well, anyway, that was the first day, and I went in and I talked to Dave, and he said, all right, take a few weeks and just mosey around and see what's going on and see what you like to do. And
really?
Yes, that was the nature of the laboratory at that time. It changed. Fortunately, it changed mostly after I left it, but that was the nature of a superb industrial laboratory at the time. In fact, Herb Holloman was the administrator there, and he explicitly told the researchers, don't worry about GE. Look at good science, and GE is a broad enough company so that any good science you do will be useful to GE. And then he had, maybe 8 or 12 people assigned. He called them liaison scientists, and their job was to see what was going on in the laboratory and also be aware of what was going on in the company and recognizing the connections there made to be.
So while you were there, did you have like an annual review where you had to present what you were doing? Or were you pretty much free to pursue your own interests?
There was an annual kind of review where you talk to your group manager about what you were doing and so forth. But so much was going on, and you just naturally developed collaborations with other people, and these would naturally come and you'd do a project or something that would then dissolve, and you'd do the project with maybe somebody else, and maybe by yourself or something.
And what kinds of projects were you working on during your Schenectady years?
Why? For a while, did met its residents in alloys measuring what are called night shifts and quadruple shifts to try to contribute to an understanding of the electronic structure of metallic alloys. Another project I worked on was the conductivity of the thin films, the evaporated films of metal. Another fellow was doing such experiments with very strange results, and I pretty much was able to figure out interesting things about how this conductivity went. A whole bunch of them.
And were you enjoying your work there?
Not completely. I don't know if I would have said that while I was there. I'd say that in hindsight, comparing it with being here.
Mm-hmm.
And there are many things about being at the university that are much more attractive to my way of doing things.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them are that there was really no punctuation in time. One project would grow and then slide out, and another one would come along and just took going. Here, there are semesters, graduate students that come, graduate students that finish, it's quite a different kind of feel in that. Another difference was that there, when you were puzzled about something, you had to learn something, you could just go down the hall and find a world's expert, and he would tell you what you needed to know, but really only what you needed to know. And when you're teaching, but also when you're working with graduate students, you have to know even more completely and in more depth than when you could depend on the colleague in the next lab to do it for you.
But I don't hear you saying that you were disappointed in the quality of the intelligence of your colleagues at Schenectady.
No. They were. This was before that laboratory. Changed completely. In fact, it occurred just about the time I left. I, in fact, left before it was very clear that the laboratory was changing direction. But within the year or two after I left, it changed very markedly and became an organization oriented toward short-term goals of GE as a business.
Uh-huh.
And so most of my, many, many of my colleagues who left in the few years after Same sort of thing happened much more recently, for example, to Bell Labs, and even to some extent to IBM Labs. Mm-hmm.
Now, was it that you saw this coming,
no,
that you left?
No. Let's see. Both my wife and I still had very strong and positive feelings about Madison and friends, and both families were nearby. I think it was true of most of the people in the lab that it's Schenectady never really became home to them, even though they had been there for 5 years.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we never felt, we said we were going to go home, and then to Wisconsin or to Chicago, where my wife was from, not to Schenectady, right?
Uh-huh.
Even though we built a house.
It was a sort of a community of transients?
To some extent. I'm not sure, but I would have supposed that if you talk to many of the people in the laboratory, they weren't intending to retire.
Uh-huh. So aside from your and your wife's personal affection for coming back to Wisconsin, did you reach a point where you knew you wanted to be a professor?
Oh, I think it just coincided with this, of course, was very shortly after Sputnik.
Mm-hmm.
And so this was a time of tremendous growth in the sciences in general, and also here in Madison. And so the physics department was high, and both in the physics department offered me job the year before I accepted, which I the first turned down. Then they offered me a job the next year at one tenure. And
With tenure?
And in that year also, my father had died, and that was another reason to come back.
Uh-huh.
So that second time, we accepted the offer.
And what was the offer? To come back and teach and research? Were they hired you for a specific area?
Well, they knew what area I was in,
uh-huh,
and I presume, although I, of course, wasn't in the deliberations, I presume that they were interested in expanding in what then we called solid-state physics, now we call it condensed matter physics. As I said, the department was dominated by experimental nuclear physics, and they were growing, they were beginning to grow then a high energy group. And then they had a few other things like the remainder of the low temperature Dillinger and Bill Beeman and atomic spectroscopy with Julian Mack and Dick Dexter, who had come back a year before. It was the only condensed matter physicist here. it was nationally a growing area, particularly because of the semiconductor business. So I presume they knew what area I was interested in, and I presume that they were interested in adding another person in that area. And this question about hiring to teach or do research, is just really never a question in the physics department. You hire people, and it's essentially understood that, of course, you do both.
Mm-hmm. So you came here, this would have been the fall of 61 or 62?
Fall of 61.
Uh-huh. Best I can remember. So you've been here ever since. You've had a 45-year career here at the university.
Well,
it's quite extraordinary.
I retired 9 years ago. So.
Yes. But you're still here. You're still
doing
some work or teaching on occasion, I suspect.
I have fun because my colleagues have to go out of town, and I get a chance to substitute for an occasion.
Uh-huh.
I enjoy that. But other than going to talks and going to lunch, I can't say that I do anything useful.
So when you came back, and it's in the post-Sputnik era, what were some of the courses that you were teaching early on? And was there high student enrollment, student demand for the courses?
The first course that I taught, I can't even remember its number then, the numbering system has changed, but it's what is now 551, and it was the first graduate course in solid state physics. At that time, I can't remember exactly, but we would have maybe 60 or 80 students in the class, and we taught the course both semesters and with a visitor in the summer. And the reason was that, of course, there were our own students, but we had people from all over, from all of the engineering departments, and from chemistry, and from geology, and so forth, because there weren't any other similar courses on the campus. Now, these other departments have their own courses covering that part of the subject matter that is most pertinent to them.
Mm-hmm.
So, whereas at that time, that particular course was both important in-house and as a service course, it is no longer as important as a service course thing as it was. There's still quite a few people that come over, but now we teach it to 15 to 30 instead of 80 or something.
Do you wonder if the intellectual vigor of that course and the study of physics in general is diminished because you don't have as many different disciplines taking that course as you did back in the days when you were teaching it as a service course? For instance, it would have been interesting to have geologists and chemists and engineers.
No, I don't think so. I think that it was a foundations course, so it was fundamentals that all of these people had to learn, regardless of what department they were in. If anything, the course has become, as all of the physical courses have over the years, become more sophisticated and challenging than.
Interesting. This concludes side two of tape one. This is side one of tape two of the March 14th, 2006 interview with Emeritus Professor of Physics Maurice Barney Webb. Barney, were you also developing other courses on your own that reflected your area of expertise?
No. I taught a number of other courses, but I wouldn't say that I developed a particular course. Whereas in many departments there are seminar courses that the professor has with his graduate students, we don't call them courses. We have all of the contact in the meetings and the da da da, but they aren't courses.
Did you start out because you came here with tenure? Is that correct?
Yeah.
Did you start out with graduate students, serving as advisor to graduate students?
Yes, I think by the end of the first semester I was here, I had three graduate students.
Mm-hmm. Now, Professor Joint, Robert Joint, said to me that you taught a course 244 to electrical engineers, and he said was a
later.
That was later.
I taught it many times. It's an introduction to modern 5th century quantum physics, which is really the underpinning foundations of modern electronics and lasers and so forth. So it's important for those people to have a background in understand at least fundamentals of quantum mechanics. So that's what this course really was. It was great fun because it spans the most exciting topics in many many exciting topics in the development of physics for the last century.
And what are some of those topics?
Well, quantum mechanics itself, things like quantum mechanics and how quantum mechanics lets you understand first atoms and then molecules and then solids and lasers and so forth. So it's a real fun course. I wish that the students had taught it. They a large it was a required course for the electrical engineers.
Oh.
And
undergraduate or graduate?
Undergraduate. This is was supposed to be the introduction to this material that then they would use when they went back to their department and learned about solid-state circuits and transistors and lasers and so forth. So this was supposed to be the underpinnings of that. But a lot of them didn't really think they needed it. A lot of them were computer architecture people rather than software people rather than hardware people and so forth. And for some reason that I never understood, many of them thought it was hard. I don't think it should have been hard. It was very busy. Lots and lots of material. So in that sense it may have been hard.
So I take it they complained to you about how hard the course was.
Some. There were some kids that just loved it, and then there were a lot of them that didn't really appreciate why they had to be there.
Now, while you are conducting your teaching, you're also conducting your own research program.
Yeah.
Here. And what are you working on here? How has that evolved over the years?
I'm not doing any research.
No, I mean back then.
What? That's the question.
From when you started teaching here in the early 60s until you retired, what was the gist of your research program? What were the areas you were investigating?
Well, when I first came, I was really started with two programs. One had to do with the electronics structure and properties of organic materials. And that, well, I had one student finished in that. And I gave that up as soon as he was done, and I started doing what's called surface physics. At least in the modern, modern probably the wrong word now, but just at that time, there was the beginning of a whole new interest and effort in understanding the surfaces of materials. And by the surfaces, I mean the properties of the last layer, atomic layer, or the last few atomic layers on the surface of a material. just interacted with other things, like in chemistry, most catalysis takes place on the surface. Crystals grow, of course, on their surfaces. Crystals communicate with their environment through their surfaces. And it has become exceedingly important in microelectronics. And it's closely related to what is now called nanotechnology, because when you make things much smaller, like in nanotechnology, a bigger and bigger fraction of all the atoms are outside. And anyway, it was at that time, people would argue about whether 2 years earlier or 2 years later, but it was at about that time that there began to be this interest because of several things. One was ultra-high vacuum. These are chambers in which the pressure is exceedingly low, so that if you prepared and cleaned a crystal surface, it wouldn't be immediately covered by stuff coming from the residual gas and chamber. What are called ultra-high vacuum techniques were becoming tractable. Also, various experimental techniques about how to investigate a surface were becoming available. And one of those was what's called low energy electron diffraction. An electron, as you probably know, has wave-like properties, and therefore it can diffract, just like light diffracts from a gradient or something. Or like X-rays diffract from a crystal. The point about the low-energy electrons is that they don't penetrate a solid material more than an atom or two distance. And that's why they're a tool to study the last few layers of atoms. And I had maybe the last year that I was in Schenectady, I helped a guy. Well, I'll step back one step before that. About the year before I left, a guy named Lester Berner visited the laboratory and gave a talk. Now, Lester Germer is the Germer of Davison and Germer, who discovered the wave-like properties of the electrons by seeing their diffraction, for which Lester Germer was the junior of the two. Davison won a Nobel Prize for that experiment. But anyway, Germer came to the laboratory and gave a talk about this, and that interested us. And another guy at NIS built an apparatus. I left before interested in the first place. So the first thing I did here was to build an apparatus to do low-energy electron diffraction from surfaces.
And you worked on that for a number of years while you were here, is that right?
For nearly all the time I was here. I did a few other things here and there, but up until maybe the last 5 or more years, that was the major part of our work.
Now, were you working with colleagues here?
Now, let's see. Of course, my graduate students, so I think of more as colleagues than graduate students. And we did a whole bunch of experiments that all were reasonably successful. And then we started doing an experiment where we let noble gases, xenon in particular, come down onto the surface of a single crystal of silver and we'd say adsorb, or fissorb. Found some interesting results. It gave you a chance to look at a pretty good approximation for some two-dimensional physics, because the purpose of the silver seemed to be just to make a plane that the xenon atoms could move. But otherwise, the properties were pretty much due to the interaction amongst the absorbed xenon atoms, which is very different than, for example, in what we call chemisorption, where you make chemical bonds. But anyway, a graduate student named Phil Cohn started this. He's now a professor at the University of Minnesota. And he gave a seminar here, and Lou Brock, who was a theorist here, got very interested. And so then there was a span of 3 or 4 graduate students, and maybe a span of 10 years, where Lou Brock did a lot of theoretical work and helped us in interpreting the results. That turned out to be a very, very successful collaboration and so forth. Well, that's when Lou Brock got started or interested in this field of physical absorption, and even though we left it to move on to mainly semiconductor surfaces, Lou has stayed with it, and to this day he may be the most, or certainly one of the very few most prominent theorists about physiosurgical systems in the world.
Really?
Yeah. It's done a passage amount of work. Started all with this, got the idea.
a book on prison selection, maybe 10 years ago or so. He gave me a copy of the book, and in the front it says this all started at this Phil Collins seminar.
Who was one of your graduates?
Who was a student who started it.
That has to be quite satisfying, too.
Yeah, that those particular experiments were fun. Lots of the others were, too.
Now, Bob Joint said that a lot of your work in surface physics on silicon has been essential for the development of the computer industry.
Oh, probably an exaggeration. It's certainly an exaggeration if he meant that any particular work that we did was important. What he must have meant was that surfaces of silicon, gallium arsenide, and so forth, are exceedingly important in chip manufacturing and design and so forth. And that's becoming more and more and more important over time as things get smaller, and as I said before, when things get smaller, surfaces become more important.
Mm-hmm.
And it was also exceedingly important in the semiconductor fabrication to be able to control surfaces, to make them clean and to orient them and in fact to misorient them a little bit and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no question that what Bob must have meant is that surface physics has been very, very central. And we developed some of the understanding and so forth. We and lots of other people. But I think he meant that the kind of fundamental things that we were interested in turned out to be important for them. Not that anything I in particular did for the semiconductor.
Okay. Now, it sounds like that there were several directions that the Department of Physics had commitments to: nuclear physics, solid state physics, surface physics. Was that ever an issue in the department? Remember, this is for history.
Yes, well, let me in the first place say that I don't think anything I say is unique to the physics department here.
Uh-huh.
But when the department has always had various groups of people, and these groups, as you would expect, and in fact, as you would hope, are very ambitious and aggressive in their work. And of course, they, in the first place, they understand their area of physics better than, of course, anybody else. And in the second place, they realize better than anybody else how important it is. And in fact, they probably wouldn't be in that area if they didn't think it was the most important. So you can see why there gets to be a
a group dynamics in the whole business.
Mm-hmm.
And when resources like number of faculty positions or space or money, when those are scarce, there are going to be disagreements and tensions.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we started, I was a student, and shortly after, we had the nuclear physics group with, and Ray Hearn had made the Van de Graaff a practical device and perhaps most important nuclear device, nuclear accelerator device there was at the time. Comparable with, for example, cyclotrons, but in some sense, maybe having more precision. And so, at that time, the physics department at Wisconsin was certainly ranked in the top 5 or 10 because of the nuclear group, and it was just a real leader in that business. And then, of course, there were others who were in, as I mentioned before, I think, either individually or little groups. It was Bill Beeman, who was doing X-ray things by himself, and there was Julian Mack, and there was, who was doing spectroscopy by himself, and there was Joe Dillinger doing temperature physics and so forth. So you had a dominant group, and then you had others who weren't, who wouldn't say, in a cohesive group.
Mm-hmm.
Then, at about that, at about the time that I finished or graduate school, while I was in Schenectady, the group started what called particle physics or high energy physics. That's when Jack Fry came, and you've heard of Jack Fry, not only for high energy physics, but for his violins. Then there were several Jack Fry and but good, and who can read me, and so forth. Bill Walker. And they grew up, and that was a pretty aggressive group. In fact, my second offer came at a crisis time, I guess, with the physics department, but I didn't know a great deal about it because I wasn't here. But you'll probably learn from others, but I think it was the University of Northwestern when they raided the physics department and made very attractive offers to four of our people. I think they were Bob Sachs, the theorist, and maybe Bill Walker. And that apparently was a considerable blow up. As I said, I wasn't here, so maybe I shouldn't be saying, but Dean Ingram was LMS dean at the time. And I understand that Ingram was not willing
to have salary scales that were to the market. In other words, what I mean is that at that time, physicists were in great demand, and this outside author must have been lucrative. But he didn't want to make a big difference between people in the humanities, social studies, and so forth, just because physicists were in demand. And as I understand, this led, well, it led in the physics department. Rawlinson stepping down his chair and Dugan's coming. Ingram stepping down his dean and Ed Young becoming dean.
Step over this crisis in physics?
That's pretty much what I've heard. But anyway, one of the effects of it was that Ed Young came and realized he had a salary structure that reflected the market, but he was unwilling to make the raises, the subsequent raises in the physics department, just to this group, rather than to the physics department. And so between the time my first offer letter came and by the time I accepted it, I got a second letter raising my salary from $9,000 to $10,000.
Well, that's all to the good.
Yeah. But anyway, so there were those tensions.
This is side two of tape two of Emeritus Professor Barney Webb.
And so then high energy physics grew up. Brian Kennedy, Walker, Good. And then about that time, a few years after I came, they hired Don Kirst, who was actually a superb physicist. They had a big problem much over there. And it changed to plasma physics and started plasma physics here at Wisconsin. He became the major plasma physics university research group in the country. There were some tensions between the high energy and the plasma people. Both of them very successful, and so I said we had to expect with their industry and their interests.
And when you say tensions, you're talking about resources.
Yes. Essentially, resources, maybe some little bit of undercurrent that my physics is more important than your physics, or my physics is more fundamental than your physics, or you ought to be over in engineering instead, or things like that. But those mainly tensions when I would talk about those resources. Part of it difference
is that unlike years ago, unlike, for example, when I came, accelerators, which were the biggest scientific instruments, I think, were owned by universities. They weren't national facilities. You ran the Van de Graaff here with, there were three professors that all had their own experiments and their own graduate students, their own particular niche of the experiments, and they shared time on this machine, but that was the extent of it.
Mm-hmm.
And now, in some areas, like high energy physics experiment now, there may be 3,000 collaborators, and 30 countries involved,
mm-hmm.
and have a facility sitting over in CERN, so they, how that physics is done and what the role of the individual physicists, the roles of the individual physicists are, and how to, if you will, evaluate contributions, that are so different. It's so different than, for example, what goes on in condensed matter physics, atomic physics.
Yes.
That, that can lead to some misunderstandings.
So, Bernie, listening to you talk about this pulls out again something that Professor Joint said about you that we'll get into on the athletic board, which is not the subject now, but that you had a particular ability to, if not bring consensus, to get disparate groups together and talk with them and resolve problems. And he said that you were chair of the department for a couple of times at least, and maybe longer.
No, I was just chair of the department. I was chair of the department right after the bomb.
Right, and we want to get to that too. But you do seem to have an ability to say to disparate groups of scientists or perhaps just people, yes, your work is important, and yes, your work is important. Is that a fair assessment of your personality?
No, I don't know. If I had been able to get a lot of people's privileges, just because I'm not very aggressive and I'm not particularly ambitious, and so they didn't have to fear me.
Uh-huh. And that apparently has been very effective.
Well, in some ways it may have, in other ways it certainly hasn't. Let me put it this way, and that is that I have never enjoyed or liked this kind of empire building science, or I never like scrambling for grants. When I got here, I don't remember exactly, but I don't think I've probably been here for more than a month or two. And a grant officer from the Office of the Air Force Office of Scientific Research was Biscuit. And we got introduced, and he asked me what I was interested in. And at that time, this is, of course, this post-Sputnik stuff. They had more money than they know what to do with. And he said, why don't you write us and let us know what you're interested in? So I just wrote just kind of a letter. Now, it wasn't a big formal proposal or anything like that. And I got with him a really short time. He didn't regret. Now people scramble and I subsequently scramble. That's what it was like then. And I had that grant, and that grant alone, through my entire career, it changed from the Air Force Office of Scientific Research to the NSF, at the time of the Mansfield Amendment. The Mansfield Amendment said that the military people could only fund research that was directly relevant to what they needed. I certainly wasn't. And so without me doing anything, they just transferred the grant from the Air Force to NSF.
Oh.
And I just redrew it all of this time. Now, because of inflation and so forth, it has changed in character a great deal, because in the beginning, well, I might have had 8 graduate students at a time, not necessarily all on the grant, but most of them. And at the end, I could support 1 graduate student, but I wasn't going to get into the business of spending all my time writing for other grants. And so in that sense, this not being aggressive certainly is not a particular success. That was a... So I had a very small group on the scale of what I might have had if had I wanted to be more of an entrepreneur.
Barney, as you're talking about some of your graduate students, we're interested for the record in having you make observations about some of your more outstanding ones, ones who studied with you and have gone on to good careers elsewhere.
This is the most gratifying part of my career, is that I just had tremendous friends. And I think almost without exception, they have gone on to very successful careers, and almost without exception, they've stayed in physics and so forth. You want particular?
Yes.
I wish I had a list in front of me. My memory is gone, but anyway, I suppose the most well-known of my graduate students, and not so valid, was a professor here in materials science, and member of the National Academy of Engineering, and so forth. So he's maybe the best known. I have a number of graduate students who are gone on to academic places. Phil Cohen, a professor at the University of Minnesota, German tourist. Well, John is a good, he's had a fantastic career at the Bureau of Standards, now called this. Billy Merrill, who writes, you know, is a professor at the University of Maine. One of my graduate students left physics and after finishing his PhD, went to medical school and became a physician. I think every other one has been a physicist.
And would you say most of them went on to academic positions?
I wish I had the list in front of me, but Conrad is a professor at Georgia Tech. So I said Phil Cohen is from Minnesota. William Merrill is at the University of Maine. A couple are at small schools. One is at a university I can't pronounce in Taiwan. It's Taiwanese. Then Art Potts became the corporate scientist for the 3M Corporation. I got a gold engraved invitation to come to his investiture. So he is one of the only things that begins to make me feel old is that I think now I have 5 graduate students who have already retired.
Yes, I could see how that might make you feel a bit older. Interesting. Barney, any other observations about the department generally, how it has grown, changed, evolved, strengthened, weakened over your 40-plus years here?
In some sense, it's a bit strange in that I personally believe the department is a great deal stronger now than when I was a student or when I first came. And I'll say a bit about that in a moment. At the same time, the department, I think, is not as highly ranked as it was then. And I think that's for two perhaps related reasons. One is this phenomenal dominant success of the nuclear group with Ray Herb's Vandegraaff. Nuclear physics is nowhere near as prominent as it was then. And our nuclear physics group is really only got one guy left, and in fact, nationally, there's nowhere near as much nuclear physics as in some sense it's closer to being done. So that's one reason that the department, even though better, isn't ranked as well. And the other reason is just that so many other departments around the country have grown so well and so excellently. So the competition hasn't been standing still. There have been periods when we haven't, because of resources haven't been hiring than the other periods we have. Now, as far as why I think we are so much better now than before, is that we're a much broader department. As I've described before, we have a nuclear group and then a few outliers.
Yes.
And now we have a high energy group that is big and strong. We have a plasma group, even though small in the faculty numbers, and three or so, but large as far as total effort, number of scientists and the budget and so forth, and a very prominent, successfully grown now quite a large, I don't know what you want to call it, astrophysics, space physics, astrophysics, cosmology sort of group. We have grown in solid state or condensed matter physics. Condensed matter physics has always been a huge effort as far as physics in the country in general. Mm-hmm. There are probably more condensed matter physicists than there are any other country. But we have only Dick Dexter and myself for a long time. We did have to bring out some theorists, who and Dr. Dick Huber. But now, we have, in the last few years, it's just been tremendous. We hired Franz Hensel, who is absolutely superb and internationally recognized guy. We hired Sue Coppersmith, a superb theoretical physicist. She's now our chairman. We have Bob Joint. We have Andrei Chubukov, who are marvelous theorists. We have absolutely exceptional young man, Mark Erickson, also Mark Ruskowski. So, through most of the time I've been here, we have been an insignificant group. In the last 10, 15 years, we've grown to be a very respectable group. Now, there's also a very, very fine atomic physics group with some marvelous new hires. And recently, although I don't know much about it at all, we hired several string theorists. For a long time, the department did not have a very strong fundamental theory. We had a strong, it's called a phenomenology group, but in general we were weak in fundamental theory for quite a long time. And now that's improved. So I think the department is much stronger than when I was starting, when I was a student or something. Mm-hmm. But probably relative to all the other physics departments, it doesn't have this sort of unique position it had when we had the Van der Graaffs.
Very interesting. As you look at the department today, are you relatively content?
What do you mean?
Pleased with?
With the department?
Yes.
Yeah, I think we have done trying recent hirings in the faculty have been very good. There always had been a tendency that's very understandable that a fellow with a big project wants a close colleague. And that may not have always led to getting the best possible person. I think there has been in the past some occasions of that, but I think now we're much better in that regard than we had it sometimes in the long ago past.
Barney, I want to switch to one thing again that Bob Joint told me about and strongly encouraged me to ask you about the fact that you received the Davis and Gummer Prize from the American Physical Society. He said it's a great honor and that it's only awarded every 2 years. When did you receive it and what does that mean? I know you were talking about Gummer earlier when he came to Schenectady.
Well, the Davis and Berman Prize, the Physical Society has various inbound prizes. There's the Bonner Prize in Nuclear Physics that years and years ago they heard and partial and then there's a important prize that in solid state physics. And then Bell Labs endowed it a long time ago. 20 years ago, gave us a Gurney Prize, which is both in alternate years, it's given every year, but in alternate years, it's given to the family business. And in the intervening years, it's given for service. And I think this was a stacked committee.
I don't think so.
I think it was 1987. And it happened that all of the, or many of the committee members happened to be good friends, but I guess that might have been true in a good part of the surface science community, so it might be hard to avoid stacking the committee.
Well, Bob Joint said it was quite a significant prize for someone working in surface physics, and that you received it.
Yeah, that's true.
And I just thought that the record should reflect that, and in case there were anything else you wanted to say about that. Let's switch now to, for some of the university history, the development of student unrest on campus in the late 1960s around the Vietnam War, leading to the Sterling Hall bombing, and all of the aftermath. And you were clearly at the center of much of that. And certainly the physics department was.
Yeah.
So we'd like your reflections on that time period.
Well, it was certainly a very stressful time prior through the bottom. You know, everybody knows more about this than I do, but the tear gas and the group running through Sterling Hall and throwing a big fire extinguisher through the glass window of an office door that might have really hurt the occupant on the other side, and so forth. Now, my students, my graduate students, were not particularly involved. A couple of times, some of them marched with the group. It didn't overly disrupt my classes or anything. Now, of course, there was all of the agitation. I think that there was almost unanimity about the anti-war feeling amongst the physics department faculty, at least toward the end. You know, that whole anti-war thing grew up over time.
Yes.
But now, there was all this agitation about federal funding that was related to military things. Now, as I said, I had had a grant by the Air Force Office of Scientific Research very early, much before the bombing. But it just, it was no different than the grant I might have had from our own research committee or from the National Science Foundation or anybody else. It had nothing to do with any military. Mm-hmm. The Air Force and the Naval Office were the first groups in the government after World War II to support fundamental research. Not for any specific military need, but just because in general you needed good scientific research. I don't know about the Army Math Research Center. You've got to ask somebody else about that. I do know that in physics, there may have been some military.
This is tape 3, side 1, March 14, 2006. Emeritus Professor of Physics, Barney Webb.
I guess I was saying that may have been grants in the department from the Army or the but nothing to do with any of their immediate needs, and nothing that was publishable without any restriction, and nothing that wouldn't have been funded by the NSF or something.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know much more than that about the lead up. I remember hearing the bang. We live on the far, far west side. But we heard the explosion, and Wilmer Anderson called early in the morning to say that Sterling had been bombed. We came down, we couldn't get in, of course. Everything was cordoned off. It may have been 2 or 3 days before we could get into the lab. I don't remember exactly when. My two labs were full of dirt and blah, 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 but I didn't have any very serious damage. I was in the courtyard that was built underground between Van Nuys and Sterling, my labs. Now at the other end of those, much closer to the ground, the debris piled up to the ceiling and so forth, and it's close to the plasma.
Was he a graduate student in physics?
Yes, no, let me make sure. I think he had just maybe had his degree and his postdoc, but he'd been here all along, and whether he had doing physics, doing low temperature physics with Fred on, and whether he had actually graduated before, not quite graduated, I can't quite remember.
Did you know him?
Oh, yeah. Well, he was a close neighbor in the building. I grew up in the temperature Well, anyway, all kinds of people know a lot more about it than I, but the recovery from it was starting, let's see what happened. Before classes, it happened about the 1st of September or something like that. By the middle of the winter or there had been all this publicity. I thought it would be important to say the physics department was still operating, that we're going ahead. So I kind of arranged.
Your chair at this point?
No.
Oh.
I'm going to be chair in 2 months. But, so I suggested we have an open house. We have everybody cooperated greatly in the open house where we showed the research and also they could look into the damaged corridors and so forth, its pictures, but mainly it was to show that the physics department was still alive and doing physics, and we were going to do it and so forth. I think that the recovery from the went pretty well. Physically it went well, and the people with a lot of damage had insurance money, the state was self-insured, but so to be able to rebuild it. One of the things that happened was that I'm not even going to name him, but the chairman at the time, the school's on session, our chairman at the time was in Colorado, and when he was informed and called right away, he this caused a lot of people to be very disturbed about that. And the department appointed a chairman for rebuilding. So we essentially have two chairmen. But there's a lot of displeasure.
Indeed.
And so when that term ended.
Of the chair.
Of the chair. They asked me to. So I did. At that time.
So you would have become chair in the summer of 71 after the bombing? In a way, that was a compliment to you, was it not? That they thought that, I can't imagine a more difficult time in the life of a department, any department, to come back after a gratuitous act of violence.
Well, I think the major problem was that, you see, the chemistry, essentially the center part of chemistry, the old mill construction, Barnes wings, we just remodeled, but the center had already been vacated. The chemists had moved over the first of their units across the heaven. And so, the planning must have been done, but while I was chair, they built the center section of the chamber, this building. And I think most of the problems that we had been while I was chair would have been related to the bombing and the reconstruction had to do with the building, this center section, and its occupancy, and so forth. There were problems. I guess I won't again name names, but there was a bit of a shenanigan. The university had a rule about 120 square feet offices, and our building chairman been able to get these offices in a courtyard that was much bigger. And of course, Helen White, I think, was, had just gone up or something, and they were all in little offices. then there were arguments about space, not only in the department, but with building and grounds. Kent Hunter is the ex-military guy who was taking care of space. So I had a lot of negotiations with him. But I think the aftermath of the bombing went certainly as well as you could expect.
Did you lose faculty because of it? Did some people leave?
Well, as part of this business about the chairman coming back and Super Hoots Barshaw, and of course he was a nuclear guy, and it was a nuclear business that most of the damage and so forth. So Lance Barshaw did leave. And he went to Livermore, that's a natural
Yes, in California.
He was there maybe a year or two, and then he came back with a joint appointment at that time between nuclear engineering and physics for many years. And then he switched and evolved to physics. But so he left. Temporarily.
Any lasting damage to the department in terms of reputation or in any regard? Or is it an incident that is remembered and has receded into history?
Well, it has both been remembered and it's both received in history, and I don't think that your first remarks were about lasting damage?
Any lasting damage to the department?
No, not that I know of. And I think that as you remember, or as you read about it, or as it's portrayed in what's been written about it, and so forth, it isn't so much focused on the physics department as on the university in general, and to some extent on the Army Math Research Center.
Right.
I'm not aware of any lasting.
Were you surprised when the bombing happened?
Well, I certainly didn't expect that particular bombing, so forth. I wasn't surprised that there was violence going on, because there had been.
Right.
But this, of course, was a huge escalation compared to the marching up and down the streets and throwing things and so forth. So that I don't know that anybody expected.
It was, it's like you were talking about physics departments across the country. I think the time of the late 60s was difficult at many of the major universities across the country.
I think that that was certainly true. I think it may have been a little more so here than a lot of places, but not as bad as Kent State.
Right. While you were a chair, in addition to dealing with what we've just covered, were there other major issues you had to deal with? Personnel, tenure, recruitment?
Okay. One of the most difficult things was that it was during my tenure that we declined to grant tenure to two assistant professors. In fact, they happened to be solid state theorists, so they were kind of in my own group, and they, of course, they didn't do very well. That was difficult. I think we did it as well as we could have. We plenty of notice, and they gave them their choice of teaching assignments, and gave them as much opportunity as we possibly could to find their next job and so forth. But it hasn't been very often. It's only been maybe 4 or 5 non-promotions since I've been here. And unfortunately, 2 of them happened while I was chair.
Did you feel, again, are you satisfied that the right decision was made in both cases?
Yes. I think by looking at their subsequent careers, that they would have been better off not being a professor at Wisconsin. And they both went off to different careers, really, and I think it's probably for the best.
Yeah.
Now, as far as hiring, you asked about, it must have been a period of budget problems again, because we, during those 2 years, we only hired 1 faculty member. And that member was Francis Halson.
Oh, really?
Francis Halson now is a very successful guy, now involved in high school.
And
he was the hire during